Our first case for this morning will be Gautreaux against the Chicago Housing Authority. Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Johnson, and I'm privileged to represent the Housing Authority here this morning, who's the appellant. 40 years ago, this case was filed, and 37 years ago, the district court found that CHA had confined African-American public housing residents to high-rise developments built in African-American neighborhoods. And further, that they had kept all the white public housing residents in four white developments in white neighborhoods. So in 1969, the district court said to the CHA, you cannot build any more public housing in African-American neighborhoods, called limited under the decree, unless you also build in white neighborhoods, which are general. You also can't build above the third floor, and you can't assign anybody on the basis of their race to a particular development. The plaintiffs and Judge Aspin have taken the position that having won that judgment 37 years ago, they are entitled to $750,000 in fees now for the time they spent in the 21st century, 2001 to 2003.
But Mr. Johnson, I have two questions for you about this. I mean, first of all, yes, this decree has been on the books for a very long period of time. Back in 1999, when this court had the case, we mentioned at the end of our opinion that if the CHA thinks that the purpose of this litigation has now been achieved under the Supreme Court's decision in RUFO, it's entirely within the power of the CHA to bring that theory to the attention of the district judge and see if you can move on. And secondly, it's not as though the last thing that happened in this case, from the court's point of view, was back in the 1960s. This has been, as the judge said, a continuing series of orders, of modifications, of fine-tuning, of changes. And the judge said this is, unlike some other cases, this has been one continuous proceeding.
Well, things have changed since the 60s, both in terms of public housing, but also in terms of the case law on when plaintiffs can recover. And the law now is that in order, while a case may go on
over for your Buchanan argument, but I want you to focus first on the fact that the judge makes the finding that the substantive orders that structure what the CHA can do have themselves been entered from time to time over the years. It's not like the last order in this case was in the 1960s. You would agree with that.
Absolutely true.
And furthermore, would you not agree that if the CHA were given two choices, number one, a world in which there is no judicial oversight of its housing building projects and tenant assignment policies and the like, the other world is one where it's still underneath the judge's consent order, you'd probably prefer the first one. There'd be no constraints aside from just sort of the general ones everyone lives under on your action.
It'd be hard for me to disagree with that. However, what we're here about is fees, and the law is that in order for the plaintiffs to recover fees, they have to secure relief against us.
And why is a consent order not relief?
A consent order is not relief if, under this court's decisions in Alliance and in Peterson, a consent order is not relief if it does not force us to do something that we don't want to do or constrain us from doing something that we do want to do.
I don't understand that, because it's nonetheless, it's an order of the court. I think Alliance doesn't look to the subjective feelings of either party. Alliance is looking at more objective criteria, and a consent order, that's why I asked the other question, is something quite different from full discretion to the CHA to do whatever it wishes.
You're right that Alliance looks at it objectively, and it looks at it in terms of what is required of the defendant. All of the orders that were entered during this period, all of the orders were agreed orders that vacated or modified provisions of the Gautreaux 1969 judgment order.
But so under conditions, like reporting to the plaintiffs was in one of the orders, as I recall.
I think if you look at the orders, most of them have to do with saying to the CHA, yes, you can build above the third floor. yes, you can build on this limited area, this African-American neighborhood. Those are direct vacating of the original Gautreau judgment order. And that, even though it is an order, even though it is a consent order, if you will, is not relief against us. It doesn't change what we are trying to do. Remember the context of this case.
But it is, in fact, I mean, the orders don't just say CHA can do whatever it wants to do. It's under the control of the court.
But only in this sense, okay? And remember the pragmatics of this. These mixed-income developments, these are part of this plan for transformation that has nothing to do with control. There is a plan developed for Cabrini, for Horner, for whatever it is, by developers who have the largest amount of money at risk. That plan is worked out. Part of the plan, and that plan is worked out separate from Gautreau. Part of the plan, then, is always that we are rebuilding on our land. That plan cannot go forward unless the Gautreau judgment order is vacated. The reason that we go to the Gautreau court is usually in the context of a closing to assure that the developer, that there's legal authority to go forward. And if you look at that order, those orders, that is what they're about. You can go ahead and build at on the Ida B. Wells property. You can go ahead and build at Horner. You can go ahead and build over three stories. These are not things that the plaintiffs have come to us to say, we want you to do. We are going to the plaintiffs to say, lift your judgment, vacate, modify your judgment so that we can go forward. That is not relief against us.
Well, and
isn't the
it's
test
certainly
established by Alliance whether the act? The efforts of the plaintiffs bore fruit during this period?
Right. Fruit, relief.
You're saying they didn't bear fruit.
They didn't bear any fruit. In fact, you know what?
What do you have to do to bear fruit?
According to Peterson, according to Alliance, they have to force us to do something that we don't want to do, restrain us from doing something that we do want to do. That did not happen here.
But this change was judicially sanctioned, and there was a change in the defendant's legal responsibilities when these orders were entered. Isn't that true?
No, not true. Not true. If that was true, we would have a problem, but that is not true. The only change is that we have the ability to build where we couldn't build because of the Gautreau judgment order. That's the change.
But there's a specific number of units you can build. I mean, you may be subjectively happy, you know, with 27 units here, 10 units there. But the court's telling you there's a judicial order in place that tells you what you can do.
If, in fact, we wanted to build 30 units and the order said, no, you can only build 27, or we wanted to build 15 and the order said, no, you have to build 27, then you would have a point. But the reality is,
you're supposed to know what you, again, you say you're not, but I think you're making a subjective argument.
I don't think so, in the sense that there is a record of what is proposed in each one of these, with respect to each one of these orders. And there is no evidence by way of finding of the district court or no evidence in this record that because of our visit to the Gautreau court, anything changed in terms of the number of public housing units to be built, the mix, the location of the buildings, the size of the buildings. Nothing was changed. And if in fact there was evidence in this record or a finding by the district court that, yes, you know what, they, through negotiation or whatever, forced you to do more public housing or a different mix.
You're saying there's got to be an adversary situation.
Yes,
that,
because
right?
You know what? I know I'm beyond my time here. But
there was an adversary situation in Alliance, but the plaintiffs lost.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And you don't have an adversary situation.
We don't really have an adversary
system.
You're
telling us anyway.
In fact,
you do have a consent decree. It's not like Buchanan, where they draw the line between an out-of-court settlement and a judicially entered decree.
Well, the key in Buchanan,
if you violate this, if you don't build the 27 units, or if you build 35, you could be held in contempt.
If the order specifies the number of units, but the point is they didn't hold us in contempt, okay? And there is no relief.
At that proceeding, presumably you're complying, you know, so.
I just want to close by saying this. This case has a long history of animosity between the CHA and the plaintiffs. There was lots of fighting that went on in the 60s and the 70s. Those fights would certainly generate fees, even under today's fee law, all right? We have during this period a era of good feelings, if I might put it that way. We have cooperation.
Yes.
We have, we don't have, if you look at this record, there is nothing contested. These are agreed orders. There is literally nothing contested.
So if we agree with you, we would, you're essentially asking us to find that one party must lose in order for another. I mean, that's really the
bottom
line.
There has to be relief.
There has to be a loss.
There has to be relief.
But that doesn't, I don't think that squares with, well, go ahead. I know you want to save some time for rebuttal.
I will. Let me say one other thing. In Alliance, the city moved for modification of the decree. The Alliance plaintiffs fought them and lost. This court said, hey, you cannot recover fees for that. Here, we move for modification of the decree. We move for that. They agree, and somehow they're entitled to fees. With that, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Polakoff.
Good morning, Your Honors. Alex Polakoff for the plaintiffs. Contrary to what you've just heard, I'm going to give you three separate reasons to show that plaintiffs did obtain fruit, significant judicially awarded relief that did force changes in CHA's conduct. The bottom line you'll see is that orders were entered during this fee period after extensive negotiations that first explicitly provided relief to plaintiff families in the form of, quote, desegregated and mixed-income housing opportunities, and second, imposed detailed conditions on CHA, not just one or two, on what CHA could or couldn't do, even giving plaintiffs a veto power over whether certain public housing units could be developed at all. Now, that's fruit, and that's change in what CHA's legal obligations are. My first reason, before turning to the language of the orders themselves, which are reasons numbers 2 and 3, is what CHA's executive director, Terry Peterson, says in his affidavit about the lengthy negotiating process that led up to the entry of these orders. Quite different than the picture painted in CHA's briefs, which picture is that plaintiffs simply acquiesced in what CHA wanted and got out of the way.
What was really required, though, wasn't it, was a waiver of the requirements of the original decree, which would
CHA
needed that waiver. This kind of development.
CHA wanted that waiver, and we were willing to give them that waiver on certain specified, carefully negotiated conditions to assure that the results of giving them that waiver would be the relief we wanted. Mixed-income housing, which back in 1995 the judge had accepted as relief in this case, even though it was in blacked areas, but mixed-income housing under specified, articulated, judicially imposed conditions. We didn't want to build mixed-income housing at a certain site and stick all the public housing off in one little corner and resegregate it in that fashion.
But again, you agreed to waive or modify your own order, and so how do you have prevailing party status?
Because, Your Honor, that was only, the waiver was only a part of the order. The conditions imposed are also a part of the order. They forced change in CHA's conduct, as I'll show you. But apart from the conditions, the waiver enabled plaintiffs to get the kind of relief they wanted, which was mixed-income housing under appropriate conditions. Without the waiver, we couldn't get it. We argued that in 1995 in the Horner context before Judge Aspin. We said, Judge, look, things have changed. This is 1995. We want opportunities for plaintiffs to live in decent conditions, integrated housing today with a longer range, economically integrated housing today with a longer range prospect of racial integration down the road.
But of
he
course,
accepted
the CHA's
that as a
position,
form of relief.
Yeah, the CHA's position, though, is that this plan that it has and other things, let's say outside the context of these negotiations, would show us that that's exactly what the CHA now wants, too, which in a sense has to be regarded as a victory all around, I would think, you know, if that's their goal, too. But if they sign a decree that just sort of ratifies that they're going to do these things and make everybody happy, can it be said that you've prevailed? Can it be said that they've prevailed? I don't. Maybe
as
nobody's
you said,
prevailing.
Your Honor, in a consent decree, subjectively, everybody wants the result. How do you get to a consent decree? You get to it in the normal case, as we're all familiar with, by careful, intensive bargaining. The result of the bargaining is an order that both sides, quote, want, but neither side gets everything it wanted. Some wins, some loses. That's a consent decree.
Let me ask you this. If you had opposed the modifications and lost, then you would not have been a prevailing party.
Correct.
All right. So, well, doesn't that suggest that we should view these proceedings as independent proceedings?
Your Honor,
And, you know, at what point would the proceedings in this case become separable?
I believe that Judge Aspin was right. I think plaintiffs are correct also in viewing this as continuing litigation, not freestanding litigation. I want to emphasize to you, however, that for purposes of your decision today, I don't think it matters whether you view this as freestanding or continuing litigation, because plaintiffs are prevailing parties under either theory. Under the continuing litigation, of course, we are continuing to enforce the 1969 judgment order. Under freestanding theory, we have sought judicially approved fruit, benefits to the plaintiff class in this fee period, and that too makes us prevailing parties even on the freestanding theory. Let me give you one example.
I was going to say, if you could get very specific with language in the orders that you said you were going to get to, that would be helpful.
That's exactly what I wanted to do. One of the orders states specifically that the units that were authorized because of the waiver that was granted could only be provided if plaintiffs approved in writing the initial location and configuration of such units. That's at Plaintiff's Supplemental Appendix 225. That's from the order involving Horner of December 2002, that page again, PSA 225. And this is an order authorizing units to be built in a black area. Because they're mixed-income units, the court having determined that, that was relief for the plaintiffs under certain conditions, and here's one of the conditions. Quote, no units shall be provided until plaintiffs approve in writing the initial location and configuration of such units, end quote. Now, obviously, that's not doing nothing more than simply acquiescing in a waiver that CHA wanted and the plaintiffs wanted, too, under the proper conditions. The order explicitly gives us a veto power, an approval power, over the development of these public housing units. Is that something CHA wanted? Nothing in the record suggests that they wanted it, and everything in common sense tells you that they didn't want to give that power to the plaintiffs to approve or disapprove the development of those specific units. And, of course, that's a benefit to the plaintiffs, because having a veto over the location and configuration of remedial public housing units helps plaintiffs assure that the location and configuration of those units is going to be satisfactory to them. And that same veto power appears in another order entered during this fee period. I'd like to give you one other illustration of specific provisions that benefit plaintiffs, clearly benefit plaintiffs. This is the scattered site order August 2002. It's at page begins at page 374 of the supplemental appendix. The order imposes multiple obligations on CHA. Detailed provisions about maximum lease-up periods. This has to do with the scattered sites that were a part of plaintiff's remedy. Maximum lease-up periods, it spells what happens if CHA doesn't meet those deadlines, requires CHA each quarter to give plaintiff a list of vacant scattered site units and includes specific information about them. Now, it's obvious that these detailed, almost microscopic provisions were included for plaintiff's benefit, not CHA's benefit.
I just wanted to underscore that in this second order, it is plaintiffs who get these lists, not the monitor.
It's plaintiffs. I'm sorry.
Plaintiffs get the list, not the court-appointed.
No, it's the plaintiffs.
It's plaintiffs. The court-appointed receiver,
The reporting was to plaintiffs. The monitor, CHA's lingo about this, is not a monitor. The monitor is a receiver who was appointed way back in 1987 for a specific narrow technical job, namely to develop housing. The receiver doesn't represent the plaintiffs. The receiver has no monitoring function with respect to seeing to it that the judgment order is carried out. I invite your order, Your Honors, specifically to look carefully at this scattered site order. That's at Supplemental Appendix 374. It virtually reeks of what we know goes on in the real world. Careful bargaining leading up to an agreement in which there's something for this party and something for this party. And they both want the order, in that sense, CHA desires it, because it's a bargain for agreement like any consent decree, and it gives something to both parties. Now, under Alliance,
so
that's
really
relief.
You hang your hat. You really, when we get cut through everything, you hang your hat on the fact that plaintiffs had veto power and approval power.
Not,
on these various changes.
That's an example of what we hang our hat on, but the
no, but I mean,
the clothes rack has a bunch of hooks in it.
Yeah, I understand that, but I mean, when we get down to it, when we try to distinguish it from other situations where it's just a plain consent decree, I mean, it's that approval power or veto power that really distinguishes this case from some of the others where there have been rulings that everything is separable
that
and it's an independent
it, Your Honor,
standalone.
Yes. But not only that. There are other conditions like that veto power condition, scattered site order, for example, that I just referred to. There are numerous conditions spelled out in all of these orders, so we got a lot of hats hanging on that coat rack, if you will, that distinguish this from Alliance, where plaintiffs in Alliance got absolutely nothing. The tree was bare. There was no fruit on it. We have fruit scattered throughout every one of these orders, and the fact that CHA subjectively wanted this at the end, that doesn't mean that CHA is not like any party to a consent decree, winning something, losing something. If they win anything under Alliance, if we win anything under Alliance and Buckhannon, the result is that we are entitled to be viewed as prevailing parties.
Right, and actually that leads to my last question for you, which is, as long as the original consent decree, all the way back when, remains in effect, and this suit remains live, it's hard for me to envision a later consent decree like this one that you wouldn't be making the same argument about, that you wouldn't be saying we're still the prevailing parties.
A later consent decree.
I mean, because what CHA's position is essentially that some of these later decrees in this period have all been in the nature of cutting back on the amount of relief that you got originally. And if they're cutbacks, how can that make you the prevailing party?
And as you know, we disagree, but they call them cutbacks. We call them, as we did in 1995 when we persuaded Judge Aspin, this is a way to give us economically integrated housing as relief. He explicitly in these orders says, that's what I'm doing. I'm giving you relief. And there's a prospect for racial integration down the road. So you can call them cutbacks, but that's semantics. This is a way both parties have agreed to provide relief to plaintiff class in the 21st century. The judge has approved, except he's not giving them carte blanche. He's saying, you do it this way, this way, this way, spelling out conditions, reporting to us, etc.
So your response is basically, I guess it's twofold. It's one, that there is a broader goal that plaintiffs had in mind, that these decrees, certainly since 1995, the judge has recognized that as well, that these decrees are working toward. And secondly, anything but carte blanche for CHA equals some form of prevailing on your part.
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you so much. Mr. Johnson.
I think I only have a couple minutes left, so let me be really quick. Number one, there is not a word in Judge Aspin's opinion that the plaintiffs, through these snippets from these orders, prevailed. There was no finding that they prevailed on the basis of the language of any of these orders. Judge Aspin's order was limited exclusively to the idea that they prevailed in 69, and so they prevailed now, and they'll prevail forever. We've disagreed with that in our briefs. We would welcome a hearing on remand as to whether any of these little snippets were things that made any difference to the CHA's plan for transformation. We would welcome a full hearing on that. There is, for example, on this Horner order, there is a long history.
How about a remand to determine if there are any fruits?
Yes, a remand to determine if there's any fruits. We would welcome that. That was never before, it was before Judge Aspin, but he never got to that point. He just said, well, you won in 69, you won now.
But no, he's that sort of underestimates what he said. I mean, he does issue the fee award, and he was aware of the changes in law. He must have determined that there were fruits.
Well, he never
said
so.
You're criticizing him for not writing an elaborate opinion.
Never addressed it. And he relied on the 82 decision of this court, which had to do with whether the case was pending in 76. We've discussed that in our briefs. But he never got into the question of whether there is fruit here or not. And we would welcome the opportunity to test that. Each of these has a little story behind him. Let me also address the second order that Mr. Politkoff raised, which is the monitoring order, the fact that we make
well,
reports.
You're not contesting that they resulted from negotiations.
Yes, we are contesting that. Okay, and here's what happens. The reality of what happens is the number of units, the mix of the units, the configuration of the units, these are not done in the context of negotiating in control. These are done in the context of the development process that leads to a plan that then is presented to control so we can get the waivers. So I would welcome the opportunity to air this all out in an evidentiary hearing on each one of these orders. With respect to the second order that he mentioned, yeah, we agreed to report to them on scattered sites, okay, and how many were occupied and when they were going to be finished, et cetera. There is nothing clearer in Alliance than the fact that monitoring by way of reports or giving them access to information or letting them sit in on meetings or whatever, monitoring does not equal fees. That was the first argument advanced in Alliance, and it was rejected by this court. You have to earn your money. You have to win something. Nothing happened during these 2 years that was not agreed. And if there's any doubt, because Judge Aspin didn't reach it, or there's doubt on this court's part about what this one phrase in the order about the entire redevelopment of Phase 2 means, we would welcome a hearing before Judge Aspin on that issue. He never had that hearing, never reached that issue in deciding to award every penny that was requested.
Yeah, he never really had a full hearing, but when you look at his language in the order, he talks about the case involving post-judgment work and proceedings that are all part of one active, equitable case in which compliance has always been at issue and modifications and clarifications of the original order must continually be made to account for changing conditions and circumstances, and refers to the remedial stage and how important it is for the court to keep control of that. I understand there wasn't a direct finding of prevailing party, but isn't that implicit in that statement?
I don't think so, and the problem with the statement is it's not particular to what happened during these couple of years. Yes, this case has a long history. Yes, there have been battles in the past. When there's battles and we are forced to do something, sure, we have to pay fees. But that statement there's no application to what's happened. Compliance has not been an issue in this case. These are agreed orders. We've never been held in contempt. There hasn't been a contempt petition. Nobody's questioned whether we're in compliance with any order. That's never happened. That happened in the 60s and the 70s, but we're at a different point now. We're at a different point, and it has to be measured by what happened now. With that, we thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel.